أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وبه نستعين. إنه خير ناصر ومعين. ولا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم. ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين وخاتم النبيين وسيد المرسلين أبي القاسم محمد.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين، ولعنة الله الدائمة على أعدائهم أجمعين، من ليلتنا هذه إلى قيام يوم الدين. السلام على الحسين وعلى علي بن الحسين وعلى أولاد الحسين وعلى أصحاب الحسين. My respected elders, brothers and sisters in Islam and Iman, Salamun alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Alhamdulillah for the opportunity to gather once again as mourners, as rememberers, as followers of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. Last night, with the barakah of the month of Muharram, we began a very important discussion regarding the topic of living in a culture of instant gratification. And as part of that discussion last night, it was an introduction to the topic. We tried to show how this is something which is addressed in the Quran. We have examples. There is specific references made to human characteristics which will make them prone and subject to wanting to be in the state of being in instant gratification. Tonight, inshallah, we want to further that discussion, and I want to give a couple of examples of what it means to be in such a culture and how, if we're not careful, if we're not aware of that, we can also imagine that this is the way that we should be living our lives. And then I'm going to pose an alternative, which is the Islamic alternative, inshallah. Instant gratification. What that means is that as an individual, I can have access to whatever I want without having to wait for it, because it's instant. I get instantly gratified based on whatever it is that my soul desires. Let me give you an example. With the internet and being online and having things like Google, what that lets us do is that we can type in any search keyword and get relevant web pages related to that keyword. That's the way it started out, at least, back in the days. The idea was that, okay, there's all this information out there that people want to have access to. Let's make that information accessible to them by just searching for it, which can be used for a very good purpose, and it is used for a good purpose, and it's something which we all make use of. But it's not limited to just that, because when technology allows us to do such a thing, then the possibilities are endless. And those who want to exploit the technology for their own purposes, they now have the grounds and the means for doing so. Let me give you a specific example, which is that of sexual gratification. Now, some of you might be cringing when I use these words and saying, do we really have to be using these terminology in these words? And my answer is, yes, we do have to be using this terminology in these words. Because we are living in an era where instant gratification also involves instant sexual gratification as well. You see, brothers and sisters, there was a time when the natural situation which was there made it difficult for people to be able to fulfill their base desires except through lawful means. They would have to, for example, when it came to sexual desires, they would have to get married and do things in a lawful sort of way. But with technology, with internet, with satellite TV and other sorts of media, now the entire situation has been changed. What they say is that this century is not the century where people have access to sexual gratification. That's already done. We've been there, we've done that. They say that this century is about having different variety of sexual gratification. Things have changed completely because it's been a given now that people can have access to whatever they want, however they want it as well too. Before, it used to be about typing in a search word and getting information. Now it's about imagining and just having a thought about something. And it could be stemming from the akal or it could be stemming from like our low desires. Typing it in and being given as much interaction as possible in a virtual means with that thing. And you might say, okay, until now it's been through a computer screen. But even that's changing as well too. When you put it into the glasses, then it becomes almost as if it's the real thing as well. And this is the way that society is marching forward. This is the way that the culture we're in is marching forward as well. It's interesting, if you look at the way that this is treated in this culture. I just came across headlines of an incident that took place with your mayor. I say your mayor, he's not my mayor, he's your mayor. It's interesting. Here's somebody who apparently has a problem with controlling himself when it comes to certain things. And recently he admitted, I think it was just today or yesterday, he admits that, yeah, actually, it's true. All the things that they're saying is true. I have, for example, taken drugs, and I do have a problem with that issue. Okay. Now, what is the reaction of the society to that? Just to understand the culture that we're living in. Whether it be a public official admitting a drug problem, or whether it be a public official, in America we have worse problems, we have public officials admitting this type of things, right, quite openly, using Twitter, using Facebook to do the worst lewd sort of things that one can imagine, even beyond that as well too, things that we can't even imagine. And it goes out into the public. Now what is the reaction of the people? Is it the case that they demand the resignation of that official? Is it the case that there's protests where people are saying that how can we possibly put our faith and trust in these individuals to represent us, to guide us, to lead us? In fact, if you go and look at what the reaction is, usually when these type of things come out, there's so much hype and there's so much sensation that the rating numbers actually increase. People are intrigued that, somebody can do that type of thing, and it's talked about in talk shows. Suddenly the person who might have been a no-name person becomes, you know, popular. They're talking about how before he used to just be a plain old, for example, congressman, now he can become governor of our state, these type of things. This is the reaction of the culture that we're living in. Now, this is how the culture of instant gratification works. The idea is that whatever desire that you have, even if it be something that other people consider to be inappropriate, as long as you want to do it, you can have access to that. You satisfy your desires. You satisfy your lusts however you want. And there's no idea, there's no sense of not gratifying yourself. Because at the end of the day, that which reigns supreme is I and the desires that I have. Those lusts that I hunger after. This needs to be satisfied, and there's no sense of holding back from that. Now, we need to look at this phenomenon. We need to look at it very carefully, because we can't imagine that we are immune from this. In the course of visiting different cities, going to different camps, speaking to different youth, one of the things that has become crystal clear to me is that once you are in a culture, it is very difficult, and it is only the rare person who is able to hold themselves back from that culture and protect themselves and remain clean from these things. I won't go into the details, but let's just say that if you imagine that our youth are not subject to the same temptations and the same problems, you're living in a dream world, because that's not the reality of the situation. So what we need to do, though, is we need to explain the alternative. We need to explain the real way of dealing with these things. And this is where I would like to introduce the terminology of the Tawhidi culture. I gave homework last night. I said that, what is the alternative? What is the name that we can use for that culture that we have from within Islam that teaches us how to lead our lives and operate with each other? And I asked you to go and think about what the right label for that is. The label that I'm using is Tawhidi culture. Now, why am I using that label? Because many of us have think of Tawhid. Tawhid, it means oneness of God. So what does that have to do with culture? Something I'd like you to think about, inshallah, as to why is it that we're using the term Tawhidi culture for this. Peace be salawat ala Muhammad. Islam and Tawhidi culture says no. That when it comes to our desires that we have, it's not about whatever I want has to be right there and right there without any delay. Because we're given a mechanism for being able to determine and being able to filter and say, what is it that I want? And be able to examine that and say that, okay, is this something which is allowed or is it something which is not allowed? And this check that we have, this ability to check ourselves, is what defines us as being human beings. It's what makes us different from animals. That culture that we see out there where people are free to do whatever they want and nobody even cares about it is something which we have to find despicable. We have to see it as being something which they are actually destroying themselves with. What are the harms of pornography? What are the harms of pornography? The harms are many. You can talk about the effects they have in breaking up families. This happens. Pornography is a means of breaking up families. You can talk about the harms they have when it comes to damaging one's own physical health. If you go and look at some of the research they're doing about the effect of somebody who becomes addicted to pornography, they say that it turns into something where their brain becomes rewired as a result of being exposed to pornography. The very nature of their brain is changing. These are things which have the effect that hard drugs have on the body. But even above and beyond that, what Islam tells us is that it's not just about the body, it's about the soul as well. These things which may seem pleasing to the body, that may seem like if I just do this thing and press this button right here, then I'm going to be enjoying myself. Actually, what's happening in the soul is utter destruction, utter havoc. Kam min sa'ati shahwatin awrathat huznan tawila, Imam Ali alayhi salam. How many times, how often it is that a moment of shahwa, a moment of acting on our base desires without checking that with the aql to see whether this is allowed or not, the result of that is that it's going to produce and result in huznan tawila, a long and extended period of grief. What is that grief that he's talking about? Somebody might say that, no, there's no grief involved. What are you talking about? Right? It's all fun and joy. Right? We do this one day, next day, do the same thing, next day do the same thing. The Imams, alayhim as-salam, know the human being and the reality of a human being. They know what it is that we actually want and we actually need. We have to trust them. We have to understand that they're coming from a perspective of knowledge where we are the ones who are ignorant. We as human beings were created in a way that we're supposed to taste hardship. And one of the ways we taste hardship is by resisting that temptation to sin. And that's what defines us as human beings. I want to go back to that example of the public official. Right? You can, in Canada, here, in America, other places. The public official who pursues his base desires, does the most lewd sort of things, or becomes an addict, wherever it is, and he goes public and nobody cares about that. Let me take that as an example and contrast that with an incident that took place during the Khalifa and the reign when Imam Ali alayhi salam was the Khalifa over the Muslims. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam had appointed one of his companions named Uthman ibn Hunayf. I'm sure you know this story. He had appointed him as the governor of Basra. He was a pious individual. He was somebody who had taqwa, somebody who had ilm. He was a worthy representative of Imam Ali alayhi salam. He goes to Basra, he begins his rule. Now an incident takes place. What is that incident? He's invited to a meal, and at that meal, there is plenty of food and different types of food. And this is at a time when people are suffering. There are poor who are going hungry. This is, now, we're looking at it from our perspective right here. We said, okay, yeah, that's not appropriate. But if we were to compare that with the types of things that politicians are doing, leaders are doing in the society we're living in, I mean, it's not comparable. Imam Ali, when he hears about what his governor has done, this governor is a representative of Imam Ali alayhi salam. He is a leader in the Islamic society. A leader in Islamic society is somebody who has to represent the values of Islam, has to live the values of a tawhidi lifestyle, a tawhidi culture. When he hears that this is what his governor has done, he writes him a letter, and in that letter he reprimands him, he castigates him. He says that if you want to take an example, take my example and see how it is that I lead my life and the simpleness that I have, and simplicity that I have in my life, the zuhd that I practice. It was not appropriate for you to go to that gathering right there. Immediately, he takes him to account for that. Why? What is the philosophy behind that, brothers and sisters? It goes back to what is it that makes up a human being? We care about these things. Yes, if there's a leader, even if that person is a good manager, even if that person is a good politician, if they do not have values, if they don't uphold values that a human being should have, they're not worthy of being in power. Because they're not going to be assisted by God. There's a difference of perspective here. Please say salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. I've given you one example, which is the example of tasting the pain of resisting sin. And we showed how it's the case that in this culture of instant gratification, there is no pain. That concept has been eliminated. Because whatever you want, you can have access to. Go ahead and do it. Look it up. The same concept of having no pain applies to a different area of life as well too. What is that area? It's that area of where we face difficulties in our lives. In the culture of instant gratification, there are no difficulties in life as well too. Because as soon as you face those difficulties, you do something to forget about them, to avoid them. There was a thinker by the name of, an author by the name of Aldous Huxley. He was somebody who, he was a European. Now he had a chance to travel to America. This was in the 1930s, I believe, where he traveled to America, and he, with a keen eye, was looking and seeing what was happening within the society. He was seeing the effect of the automobile revolution and the way that society was going with the sexual liberty and these type of things that were creeping into the society. And he, being from Europe, was very concerned. Because what he saw in the culture of America, he did not want to transfer to Europe. So he goes back and he writes a book in which he, it's a fictional work, a science fiction work, in which he explains and tries to show what society will be like if these same ideals of this culture are carried forward. What is it that he talks about in this book? It's very interesting. Now, he's just talking about fiction here, but we see parallels in the society today. One of the things he mentions is that there'll come a time when there'll be a society where, in order to appease the corporate interests, in order for companies to make money, one of the slogans of the society is, if something breaks, don't mend it. Just throw it away. Get something new. Right? That thing of consumerism. It's something that we're seeing today. And he talks about other things as well, too, relating to sexual liberty and other things as well. One of the things that he makes very interesting, he says that in that society going into the future, there will be a drug, a pill called Soma. Okay, and that drug will be manufactured by the state. And it will be given to every citizen of that state, and it will be marketed as something which is very good. What is the properties of this drug right here? There's no side effects to it. Right? It has no harm to your body or anything like that. But whenever you're feeling a little bit down, whenever you're feeling a little bit depressed, okay, if you want to go on a vacation, there's no need to like spend money or, you know, like book flights or anything like that. All you have to do is sit down and take this pill right here. If you take one pill, then you start feeling good and you'll, you know, have a happy feeling. If you take two, then you might even be able to like sleep and then dream about something, and so on and so forth. He described this whole thing where the solution to any problems that we face is that we take a pill, and there we go. The problem is solved for us. Now, he's speaking in the 1930s. But it's interesting, as we fast forward to our current times, and we look at the way that this culture deals with problems, we're seeing a lot of similarities. The slightest issue that comes up, where do we turn to for help? We go to the doctors. Oftentimes, what they'll do, if they see even the slightest bit of depression, is that they'll prescribe the antidepressant drugs. Now, I'm not here to say that these antidepressant drugs are wrong or that people shouldn't have them. No, this is a medical issue. It's not my area of expertise by any means. But when we see that this is being posed as the answer to people's problems, we have to stop and say, wait a minute. That's not the Tawhidi culture. That's not what we have to and we ought to be believing in. That's not how we understand the philosophy of facing difficulties in our lives. We have examples of people who are great individuals, and the secret to their success was their ability to face problems and deal with them in a Tawhidi sort of way, knowing that God is there with them. The example I want to speak about is that of Sayyidah Fatima al-Zahra, salamu alayhi wa alayhi. Who is Fatima al-Zahra, salamu alayhi wa alayhi? I'm not qualified to speak about her. I'm not qualified to explain and describe who she is. I can just, in my limited capacity, understand a few things about the greatness of this lady. But someone like the Imam of our time is somebody who understands something about his grandmother, Fatima al-Zahra. What is it that our Imam, the Imam of our time, has been reported as saying about his grandmother Fatima? It's reported in a hadith that he says, "Wali fi ibnati Rasulillahi uswatun hasana." In the daughter of the Messenger of Allah, I have an example which is an exemplar for me. This is somebody who, an example for me, the Imam of the time is saying. How is it that Fatima salamullahi alayha reached the level that she did. She's quoted as have saying something about the difficulties that she faced in her life. What did she say? She says, "Subbat alayya masa'ibu. Law subbat ala al-ayyami lasirna layaliya." Now this is not a small statement, brothers and sisters. Right? Ponder upon the greatness of these words she's saying. That the amount of affliction that has been poured upon me, the difficulties that I've had to face in my life are such that if they were being, she makes an analogy here, that if they were poured onto the daytime, the day would have turned into night. That's the difficulties that I faced in my life. This is the example that we have of a human being. A human being is somebody who, in the face of difficulty, they respond not by trying to run away from that and to avoid it. This idea of treating all difficulties that we have, any type of depression, with drugs, that's not correct. Because after all, drugs are saying that, okay, it's purely a physical problem here. But oftentimes the problem doesn't lie in physical, it lies in our soul. And it lies in our not having a relationship with God. What the ulama and the urafa tell us is that the root of all of our problems that we face in our lives stems from a lack of connection with Allah. I want to give you two concepts, inshallah, then we'll move to the masab. I want to give you two concepts that lie at the core of the Tawhidi culture that have no place in the culture of instant gratification. What are the two concepts? Number one is sabr, and number two is dua. What is sabr? Sabr is that when something we find difficult to do, whether it be a wajib thing that Allah has asked us to do, whether it be staying away from something which is haram, yet our desires are calling us to go for that, or whether it be something, a calamity that befalls us, some difficulty that comes up in our lives, a roadblock that we come to, in response to that, we don't put our heads low, we don't crumble, we don't give up, we don't get depressed, but instead, we deal with it. And we say, فَإِنَّ مَعَ الْعُسْرِ يُسْرًا إِنَّ مَعَ الْعُسْرِ يُسْرًا. Indeed, with difficulty there is ease. Why is there ease? Because while people who don't believe in God, what do they have except for these type of things? People who believe in God have a way of going around these things and going over and on the side, because they have that connection with Allah, which makes all the difference. Let me just give you one example of sabr. And it's a very beautiful way of looking at this. The ulama have explained to us some of the etiquette that somebody who is sick is supposed to observe. Where do they get this etiquette from? They get it from the ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. Ahlul Bayt have given us instructions that when you're sick, this is the way you should be. These are not things which are wajib, right? But they are etiquette, meaning that it's good to do these things, and when we analyze them, they teach us, they give us information and insight as to how the Ahlul Bayt want us to be as human beings. What are some of the etiquette that they mentioned? Very interesting. Number one is that it's recommended that somebody who is sick should have patience and be thankful to Allah. This is completely opposed to the culture of instant gratification. We should be thankful to have patience. What we're told is that somebody who is facing a difficulty, if they can face that difficulty and go through it while being patient, that's when they will get the reward. Eventually the thing will pass. But if they can do it in the right way, then as they're going through this, the whole time they'll be getting closer to Allah. It's a means of their elevating. It's a very beautiful thing that those who don't believe in God won't understand this concept. Number two, what's recommended is not complaining about his sickness to anybody except for a mu'min. That's very interesting. Why? And when complaining to a mu'min, not to complain about it. Not to say something that, oh, I'm the only person in this world who's been afflicted with this, why me and nobody else? Not to be whining about it. Yeah, you can say it, but not whine about it. Okay, another example, that for 3 days we should conceal our sickness from others. Now, this is something which is amazing, to be patient over this. Not to immediately be complaining about this. I'm not saying, no, don't take this in the wrong spirit. If somebody is sick, they should go to the doctors. But let's say somebody has a minor sort of thing right here, just to go in, and now the whole world has crumbled because I have a sore throat or something like that. No, okay. All right, another one is that not to be hasty in taking medicine for that sickness that we have and going to the doctor unless one is hopeless, and meaning that one loses hope in being able to be cured other than these means right here. Meaning if it's something that will pass, and it's just a minor sort of thing, there's no need to make a big deal about it, right? Then don't make a big deal about it. Again, take these in the right spirit, consult your doctor. I'm not a physician here, right? But this is what we have, and they're taking this from the ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. This is teaching us something about the culture of a mu'min, the way a mu'min should be. Filled with patience, using these as opportunities. The second one I'll just briefly mention, inshallah, go to the masaib, is that of dua. The concept of dua is something which lies in direct opposition to that of instant gratification. Because dua is something which where when we're faced with a need, rather than trying to be instantly gratified with that need, we say, wait a minute, this is something which is beyond me. This is something which lies in the hands of God. Let me ask Him for it. Dua, brothers and sisters, is something which is extremely beautiful, and we as believers have to learn the art of making dua. Allah says in the Quran, "Ud'uni astajib lakum," which means that as soon as somebody is making dua, if they're able to enter into the state of dua, the real state of dua, the answer is there at the same time for them. But this is something which is so beautiful. Here we are in a culture where people think of instant gratification as being that whatever I want, I need to get it right away. But for a believer, instant gratification is something different. Instant gratification is that as soon as I know that Allah has heard what I want, then I have peace in my heart. Because I know that there is somebody who is fully aware of who I am, what I need, who is fully capable of giving me whatever it is that I need, and who has the best my best interest in his heart, meaning, figuratively speaking, meaning that he has my best interest in mind. He's going to do whatever is best for me. Meaning that everything that I could possibly want is now in place. What reason do I now have to be worried about it? I can instantly be happy and be content knowing that my problem now has been delegated to the one who is the Rabbul Alameen. Salawat. Tonight we spoke about a very important concept of the culture that we're living in, which is that of not facing pain and trying to avoid that. Inshallah, we'll continue the discussion tomorrow night with the help of Allah. I wanted to mention one point regarding the Azadari, and then inshallah mention something about the event of the caravan entering Karbala. Last night, we had the chance to mention some of the guidance that we have from our maraji' and the ulama regarding the best practices of mourning. Why is it that we gather together? Why is it that we dress in black and beat our chests and recite poetry, etc.? We left off discussing this question of, somebody might say that, okay, if the point of all of this is that we want to use Karbala as an inspiration to prepare the grounds for the coming of Imam Mahdi, ajallahu farajahu sharif. Then why do we spend so much time dwelling in the past and going through the tragedy? Why not just discuss things at an academic level, take out the lessons, and then go with that to talk about the future? And we talked about and addressed part of that question last night. There's one part I wanted to address, which is that when we do these things like poetry and plays and other sorts of artistic forms to be able to remember Karbala, what we're doing is we're trying to recreate Karbala for people who haven't seen it. You see, what is it that art does? Art helps us visualize things, because as human beings, are visual individuals, visual beings. It's not enough for us to just know what happened. We need to see what happened as well too. And this is what the enormous responsibility that those of you who are taking on the thing of writing poetry, of saying marthiya, of saying spoken word, of doing other forms of remembering and commemorating, what you're doing is you're helping the mu'mineen try to visualize what took place. This has supreme value. And this is what the Ahlul Bayt wanted. I want to quote to you an incident that took place in the life of Imam Radha alayhi salam. This incident, it's filled with lessons for us, truly. What happened is that there was somebody named Di'abil al-Khuza'i. He's a famous Shia, famous poet. He says that one time I entered into the gathering of my master Ali ibn Musa Ridha alayhi salam in the days of Muharram. And I saw him sitting the way that somebody who is grieving would sit. And his companions are also around him as well too. They're also grieving as well. You see, what we're doing here, brothers and sisters, is exactly a continuation of the seerah of the Imam alayhi salam. He tells me, "Welcome to you, O Di'abil, welcome to the one who is our helper with his hand and with his tongue." Look at the value of an azadar of Imam Hussein, a true one who does it with the right spirit in the eyes of the Imam alayhi salam. He makes room for me as majlis, and he says that, "O Di'abil, I would very much like it if you would compose some poetry in commemoration of these days right here, which is days of sadness for me and the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam." He says that, "O Di'abil, one who cries or causes others to cry over our tragedy, even if it be one other person, the reward that he will have will be given to him directly by Allah. O Di'abil, the one who sheds one tear over the tragedy that took place with us, the one who cries over what our enemies did to us, Allah will raise him in our company in the Day of Judgment." The Imam alayhi salam then calls his family. You see, he's trying to recreate the scene. He calls his family there. He puts up a curtain and he has his family, the women folk, sit behind the curtain as well too. And he tells them that the reason why I'm doing this, he explains to them, the reason why I'm doing this is that so that they may cry as well, and you will cry when they cry as well too. And then he looks at me, Di'abil says, and he says, "Okay, Di'abil, now remember Imam Hussein alayhi salam. You are our helper. You are the one who composes poetry. And do not fall short in expressing our rights." What does Di'abil do in this case? There's lessons. Di'abil says that the following. He says, "Fasta'abartu." He says that I first began by trying to make tears come down from my eyes. This is the way that we should be entering into Azadari of Imam Hussein Islam, with tears. I first tried to make tears come to my eyes. And when they started flowing down my cheeks, that's when I began to say the poetry. And it seems that this came from an inspiration, meaning that just like that, on the spot, he composes the poetry. What does he say? He says, "أَفَاطِمُ لَوْ خِلْتِ الْحُسَيْنَ مُجَدَّلًا وَقَدْ مَاتَ عَتْشَانًا بِشَطِّ فُرَاتِ." He addresses Sayyida Fatima al-Zahra. Now look at this. He has no need of saying that Fatima al-Zahra came to Karbala. But he uses her in such a beautiful way that there's no need of saying that. He says, "Oh Fatima, if only you could be there and see how Hussein is lying sprawl on the ground, and he has died in a state of being thirsty at the banks of the Euphrates River. إِذَنْ لَطَمْتِ الْخَدَّ فَاطِمُ عِنْدَهُ وَأَجْرَيْتِ دَمْعَ الْعَيْنِ فِي الْوَجَنَاتِ." If you were to see him in that state, "Oh Fatima al-Zahra, oh the mother of Hussein, then indeed you definitely strike yourself out of grief, and the tears will begin to flow from your eyes and run down your cheeks. أَفَاطِمُ قُومِ يَبْنَةَ الْخَيْرِ وَانْدُبِي." Oh Fatima, stand and grieve for what took place. What took place? نُجُومُ سَمَاوَاتٍ بِأَرْضِ فُلَاتِ. Those stars that were shining bright in the sky, They have now fallen down into the desert ground.
Sallallahu alayka ya Aba Abdullah. Sallallahu alayka wa ala ummika Fatimah az-Zahra.
It was the second of the month of Muharram when the caravan of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the caravan of light, the caravan of purity that has been moving for so many days has now come to rest. They come to a land. We are told that Imam Hussein alayhi salam turns to his people and asks them, أَيُّ مَوْضِعٍ هَذَا? What is this place that we are in? What is it called? Some people say that this is Nainawa. Some others say that it is called Taf. But then somebody says that it is called Karbala. هَذَا كَرْبَلَا يَبْنَ رَسُولِ اللَّهِ. Imam Hussein responds, he says, هَذَا وَاللَّهِ يَوْمَ كَرْبٍ وَبَلَىٰ. This is the day of affliction and tragedy. وَهَذَا الْمَوْضِعُ الَّذِي يُحْرَاقُ فِيهِ دِمَاؤُنَا. This is the place, this is, he knows, Imam Hussein knows, this is the place that our blood will be spilt in. وَيُبَاحُ فِيهِ حَرِيمُنَا. This is the place that our women folk will be subject to humiliation, to violation. Maybe at this point Imam Hussein alayhi salam is telling his companions and his family, go set up the tents in a way that the women will be protected from any non-mahrams. Maybe he is telling Abbas alayhi salam, oh Abbas, go and fill those water skins. We may need that water sometime in the near future. Maybe he is telling Ali Akbar alayhi salam, oh Ali Akbar, you see your auntie Zainab. Go and help her to come off the horse onto the ground. But what is going to take place after Ashura? These same women folk will now need to mount their horses again. But who is there to help them? Who is going to lift them up on the horse? The only man among them is Imam Zainul Abidin. And his hands are chained together.
أَلَا لَعْنَةُ اللَّهِ عَلَى الْقَوْمِ الظَّالِمِينَ وَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مُنْقَلَبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ.
Fatima Hussein.